with regards to Walmart and mass market issue, but we are going to look also into the we also realize the sensitivity around some of the issues, but we are working and we want to see some of these things be clarified and being fast-tracked. Therefore, it's our responsibility to ensure that where there's no agreement, we understand what are the hiccups, and so that we can perhaps see whether we cannot assist as this parliament. Without further waste of time, I just needed to give that background so that you understand where we're coming from. And then we are able also to follow the discussions as they unfold. We are going to allow the department, that is the, I don't know who's leading, whether it's the acting HOD, just to give us the overview or the overall expectation of the department in as far as the local procurement is concerned. You'll recall that we understand that the Minister of Trade and Industry looked at areas of main focus areas that will be looked at, especially when implementing this local procurement accord. In as far as manufacturing is concerned, we would appreciate if you can just take us through that, so that then your expectation as the department, because you are the overseer in terms of the implementation of this accord. And generally, you said we're going to have I don't know whether it's a seminar or a conference last year, October, with all the role players, especially government, SOEs, the Metro Council. How far is that? The triple PFA, which will enable the full implementation of this accord. How far are you with those issues? Can you just brief us in general on that, and how far, do you have any plan to monitor the implementation as a department, and any other relevant information that you can give us? May I then take this opportunity and hand over to you, Mr. Mauser.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and address you once again. The Chairperson did indicate the apology of Minister Patel, and given the funeral of late Minister Padiachi tomorrow, all Cabinet commitments were brought forward to today, so he unfortunately could not join us here and will be going to the Select Committee from Cabinet. So he's asked me to convey sincerest apologies, but to wish the committee well in the deliberations. Honourable Chair, we have a senior delegation from the department present with us. Our acting DDG, Mr. Duman Corsi, together with Mr. Peter Williams, Ms. Bridget Mushlala, Mr. Sipo Ndebele, Mr. Paul Edwaba, and Mr. Etienne Flock. They are part of the department's team here today. The presentation, as you indicated, will cover a broad overview of the local procurement accord, and we have circulated copies of the accord booklet. The expectations on implementation, and then the designation in terms of the preferential procurement regulations as outlined by you, which is led by the Department of Trade and Industry under the leadership of Minister Rob Davies. Mr. Flock will do the presentation, but before I hand over to him, we also have our entity, as you indicated, the Competition Commission, led by CEO Mr. Shan Rambura, and they will do a presentation after the local procurement accord. So, Chair, with that, thank you very much, and I will hand over to Etienne to commence with the presentation. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members. Thank you very much, CG. Chairperson, we will do the presentation as requested. If we can just ask the technical people to put the presentation on the screen, please.
We have the presentation. Let's use our hard copies while the secretary is looking at the whole thing, the technical aspect. You may continue. Okay?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the first slide is the cover slide. If we move to the next slide, it shows the outline which the acting DG has also set out. Firstly, as indicated, we'll do an overview of the local procurement accord, and that's followed by, as you indicated, some expectations on the implementation of the accord. And Chairperson, I see that it's on the screen now, in case members want to follow. And then finally, we go move away a little bit from the accord, moving to the designation in terms of the preferential procurement regulations, and into some of the work that's been done in that area. Firstly, Honourable Members, it'd be useful just to provide a little bit of background. The Local Procurement Accord was signed at the end of October, on 31 October 2011, following an extensive social dialogue process that involved government, labour, business and community. And it's very instructive because in the accord, it really sets out quite well what the role of procurement is. If I can quote from the accord, it says the following. It says, social partners recognize the pivotal role that local procurement can play in national development and economic growth, and in combating inequality, poverty, unemployment, and rural underdevelopment. They commit to work cooperatively through this accord to expand local industrial capacity and to prevent further deindustrialization and its accompanying social reversals. The signatories to the accord, as I indicated, were four constituencies: government, labour, business and community constituency. Government was represented by the Ministers of Trade and Industry, Finance, Energy, Economic Development and Public Enterprises. Labour by the three main trade union federations, COSATU, FEDUSA and LACTU. Business, organised business by the major business bodies, including BUSA, NAFCOC, FABCOT and Business Leadership South Africa. And the community constituency at NEDLAC, comprising of organizations of women, civic structures, youth, people with disabilities, and co-ops. The policy mandate, Chairperson, of the that instructs this area of work largely comes from the New Growth Path, with its aim of creating 5 million new jobs by 2020. The NGP commits to procurement reform to support local procurement. And in several places in the NGP, including in certain jobs drivers and in certain microeconomic programs, procurement is cited as an important lever. And these jobs drivers include infrastructure, social economy, some of the microeconomic programs include broad-based black economic empowerment, labor policies, and others. Chairperson, what was the aim of the accord? It aims to mobilize business, trade unions, communities, and government in a partnership to promote local procurement. It's believed that it can help to direct billions of rands of spending. But importantly, this is a measure that focuses on the demand side. It has to have some kind of link with the supply side. And for the court to be successful, it must link with other efforts to improve competitiveness, increase skills development, and build better economic infrastructure. Chairperson, the next few slides for the Honourable Members will focus on the contents of the accord, summarising some of the major commitments. Firstly, the signatories to the accord aspire to achieve a 75% localisation in the procurement of goods and services, with the accord setting out the first steps to achieve that target. Now, how will this be done? Government and the public entities spend billions of rands every year on products for its service delivery departments, infrastructure programs, use public procurement as a way to support productive sectors. The other social partners, business, labor, and community, have made commitments in this accord to support localization through their own procurement interventions. Chairperson, the next few slides will deal separately with the major commitments from each constituency. Government side, the first and possibly the most important commitment, it identifies designated products for local procurement in the new preferential procurement regulation. Now, I'll go into a little bit more detail later in the presentation on the specific aspect on the honourable members. Once it's established this list of designated products, it then commits itself to add more products to the designated list and to workshop such products with social partners. Government also commits to establish a standard to measure local content and to use its infrastructure program to promote localization by companies that supply government. Finally, one of the last major commitments by government is that it will train government procurement units on designation. Chairperson, you mentioned this issue in your introduction. What are the major business commitments? Companies, including the 85 largest companies, will develop strategies to improve levels of local procurement, and the court sets out the process by which they will do this. Firstly, they will analyze their supply chains for imported goods. Secondly, they will set targets to increase local procurement and measuring progress. Thirdly, identifying further opportunities to procurement from local businesses and helping such businesses. And then importantly, reporting annually on the progress that they are making in terms of implementing these specific strategies. Business also commits, honourable members, to establish a diversity council. And this diversity council will help to provide access to black-owned local manufacturers and service providers, and also assist emerging black-owned suppliers to link into established supply chains, especially supply chains that involve major companies and corporates. There are some further commitments that business makes. It commits to identify which products designated by government itself can also procure exclusively locally. In other words, those products designated by government in terms of the preferential procurement regulations, which of those products can it also commit to procure exclusively locally. Then business commits to increase investment in business opportunities arising from government designation, to eliminate collusive and unethical tendencies, including when supplying government. And Chair, this is important because in the NDP it recognizes that while procurement is an important lever in terms of job creation, it cannot be done in a way that the state is negatively affected through paying much more money than it should be paying, and in that way overspending and offsetting some of the benefits that there may be because of job creation. Then finally, BUSA and other business organizations commit to procure certain products locally, including office furniture, stationery, caps, T-shirts, jackets, and tracksuits locally. And this, just to emphasize, are the business organizations themselves. In other words, not their members, but the business organizations and associations themselves who are making this commitment. Chairperson, in terms of the major labor commitments, Kasatu Fidusa, NACTU, and their affiliates commit to procure office furniture, vehicles, stationery, T-shirts, caps, tracksuits, and jackets locally. So once again, these are the unions and the federations making this commitment. And then the unions also commit to set up a procurement desk to help businesses and community organizations that want to source locally to find local suppliers and to be able to access those local suppliers. Then the trade unions also commit that their pension and provident funds will promote local procurement in their investments. Labor also commits that part of the union investment and retirement funds be invested in government development bonds, that they would hold an investment strategy conference for trustees, and finally that they would mainstream the procurement campaign into other union campaigns and platforms. Chairperson, the final slide on the commitment focuses on the two remaining areas. One is the community constituency, and the other one is broadly South African. In terms of the community constituency, it commits to publicize by local campaign to their members and the public. And we believe this is a strong vehicle to get into different community organizations and start to publicize this message. Community constituency also procures commits to procure office furniture, vehicles, stationery, T-shirts, caps, jackets, and tracksuits locally to strengthen cooperatives and link them into established supply chains. So this is also a way that we can mainstream cooperatives and can ensure that they fit into existing supply chains, once again, especially those supplying major corporates and companies. Chairperson, in the local procurement report, there's also a section that deals with proudly South African. And in the proudly South African and the social partners commit to run a campaign on the benefits of buying labels. They also, proudly South African commits to run education programs on the labels of origin. In other words, the label on a tin of food, on a packet of sweets, on a garment, on a shoe, that says whether a product is made in South Africa or made in another country, probably South African commits to run an education campaign to the South African public on these labels of origin. And then finally, probably South African commits to develop a database of local manufacturers. One of the constraints often is that people do not know where they can buy certain products locally. The idea here is to practically make it much more easier to procure locally. Chair, also been asked to focus on the implementation of the accord and how that can be done. Firstly, within the accord itself, it sets out certain measures that will be implemented to ensure that the commitments made by different parties are carried out. Firstly, it says that the high-level committee will meet every 6 months to monitor implementation, with the first meeting due next month in June 2012, and then every 6 months thereafter. And then it sets out certain work in the accord for this committee. It says the committee will receive reports from each constituency on steps taken to implement commitments made in the accord and on the impact of such actions. It will also consider creative ways to achieve the commitments, as well as additional measures and interventions that may be required to implement the commitments, but also others that may be required to broaden local procurement. And then it says that the constituencies based on this information will develop a program of action for implementation. And this program of action will address prioritization, sequencing, actioning, and monitoring of the commitments contained in the accord. Chairperson, we've also done some practical work in the economic development to ensure the implementation and understanding of the accord. We've embarked on a capacity-building program to build awareness and sensitize government departments and social partners at provincial level about key commitments contained in the accords, including the local procurement accord. And to date, we have had eight provincial workshops in different provinces, and these have been conducted in conjunction with provincial governments, with the ninth workshop being held later in May to complete the work in the nine provinces. At these workshops, we've really tried to make sure that we include business organizations, trade union, provincial and local government, and community constituencies from the province and areas to attend these workshops in order to build an awareness of the commitments in the local procurement accord. Finally, Chairperson, just to move a little bit to some of the general work that government has done in terms of in terms of procurement, specifically the preferential procurement regulations. As the DG has stated, this is very much the work of the DGI with some assistance from other departments, including ourselves. Last year, Cabinet approved procurement regulations that require all public entities, that's national government, provincial government, municipalities, state-owned companies, to procure designated goods only from South African manufacturers. These regulations came to effect on 7 December 2011, and the first and second waves of designated products have been announced. These include bus bodies, tower pylons, rolling stock or trains, canned vegetables, clothing, textiles, footwear, leather, set-top boxes, which will be used in the new digital television signals, and then oral solid pharmaceuticals. And currently, research is being conducted on further products to designate in terms of the procurement regulations. Just a little bit of detail, Chairperson and honourable members, on the implementation of the procurement regulations themselves. Chairperson, as you alluded to in your introduction, government committed to hold a conference, and this was done late in 2011 to inform government procurement units about designation. They can understand exactly what it entails and how it needs to be implemented. Subsequently, government, industry, and the SABS developed a standard to measure and calculate local content for use in tenders. And this was a significant work, but to ensure that there's some common understanding, both by government departments, SOCs, and others who put out tenders, but also by those who will be tendering for that specific work, that there's some understanding on what is how to measure local content, so that this could be included in tender documents, and the government can then see what is local content in those specific tenders. And then following this, instruction notes and bidding documents have been finalized for distribution to the municipalities, the provincial governments, SOCs, and the national government departments. The public infrastructure, or the PICC, has also incorporated the local procurement goal into its framework and as one of its objectives, and that's in line with what is set out in the local procurement accord in the commitments by government, that it will use infrastructure as well to promote local procurement. Chairperson, in conclusion, I believe that the local procurement accord is significant because after many years of disagreement about goals, a new consensus has been forged and captured in the local procurement accord. Practical steps are now being taken in the public and private sectors to reorient supply chains to support and increase local procurement. And one example of this was the agreements that our minister publicised in the during his budget vote on the 24th of April to members of the committee and others. And then finally, a detailed report on the impact of the local procurement accord will be presented on the anniversary date of the accord. Chairperson, thank you very much, and thank you to honourable members.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flock. I think members, you're seated awkwardly now on my left, but I'm used to sitting on the right, but it's okay. Here's the presentation. I think it's quite broad enough, and I think he even went into some detail. I'm not sure whether you've managed to cover the expectations in terms of other government departments and broadly the entities themselves, but I think that would come from members of the session. May I recognize Member Ntuli, Member Hussein, Member Mubu, Member van der Merwe, Member Gwabaza, in that order, please.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. And we would like to welcome the presentation. It is simple and straightforward. And we would like to commend the department for that. Chairperson, if the department can just name few companies, these big, largest companies. I don't mean 85, just few. And then, all along, Chairperson, we were talking about co-ops being given a slice of local procurement to supply hospitals, is not coming out here. They just mentioned at the beginning that they are part of NEDLAC, but you don't hear anything. And I was thinking that that's where it is going to come up. The other thing is SMEs. We would like to check whether these companies do assist the SMEs, like capacity or capacitating these SMEs. I remember that with Walmart, we did specify that they have to do something to capacitate the SMEs. Do we have any funds from these big companies put aside for the co-ops and SMEs to capacitate or to give them that leverage? We want to see that. Let's say maybe these big companies, after we have told me their names, just to check corporate social investment. What do they do to uplift the communities around? I mean, putting this local procurement, because that's where I think if we want to fight the COVID particular and the unemployment, if we can utilize this local procurement thing to co-ops, to uplift the co-ops and the SMEs, it can go a long way. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Mbabintuli. I'm hoping that you're noting the question.
Chair, thank you very much. I want to start by saying that I think the comments and the content of the document is very fabulous. I want to recognize the fact that it's a very good initiative. I'm personally a great supporter of initiatives, so I want to say that up front. But I think we all recognize that what affects our people on the ground is not the content of a document, but the outcomes of the plan. So there I focus my attention on that. And I find it very interesting in the document, which I think is very good, that major businesses have taken the initiative to analyze the supply chains for imported goods, because that tells me that there is a genuine attempt to try and measure the extent of imported goods as opposed to locally procured goods. Has the same initiative been taken on government side? And has that measurement been done? Or is it going to be done? If it's done, could you perhaps paint a picture of what the reality looks like? Perhaps it's an unfair question at this point, so you may not have that information, but if you do have it, it will be interesting to know just what percentage of our goods that government is procuring are actually local goods. The second one is what speaks to my opening comment, and that is the issue of monitoring the implementation and measuring the outcomes of the accord. I think many of us will recall that over the years there's always been a public uproar about the number of government departments and labor unions purchasing T-shirts, for example, from other countries. When we ourselves have a massive failing textile industry. And I would just like you to expand on that a bit more to give us the confidence to know that we're actually tightening up on that sector to ensure that this thing actually happens. Because, I mean, I understand it's in accord and there's a genuine willingness from all parties to try and make it work. But unless you really track and trace this thing every step of the way, it's not going to happen the way you would like it to happen. Then I come then, Chair, just to the last point, and that is on the issue of Proudly South Africa. And there again, I think it's a fantastic initiative that has been started many years ago. But my big concern is that perhaps there's been a fair amount of work being done to promote the supply side. I don't think there has been enough work being done to promote the demand side from the consumer on the ground. Because without that, you could promote as many South African products as you can, but if the consumers on the ground themselves are not buying it, then it's going to fall apart. And I'd like you to perhaps talk on that. And do you have any plans on that to get to increase the demand and promote it on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mabu.
Thank you, Chair. Also like to add a word or two about the presentation, which I think was informative. I've got a couple of things I'd just like to get clarity on. In our briefing note from our researcher, we note that the Department of Road Development was involved in the drafting of the accord, but they were not involved in the they're not signatories to the accord. I'd like to know how will the rural economy benefit from the infrastructure development if they're not part of this accord? Because I'd like to think that in a program such as this, I think it's imperative that rural areas are involved in supply of goods, for example, so that we also capacitate the rural areas in terms of development. So I'd like to know why this was not done. Secondly, the tendering process, is there any mechanism that will try to stop corruption? Because in this kind of program, it's very, very easy to have underhand people involved in the procurement and supply and things like that. So what mechanisms are in place to circumvent this? Thirdly, I'd like to know, in offering tenders to some companies and to have the ability or capacity to supply the goods, we've read in the past that some companies tender for products, to supply services or products, but then they don't have the capacity to do that. But in the end, they probably order these products from somewhere else and present them as if they are the ones who have produced those goods. What mechanisms are going to be put in place that my colleague here mentioned T-shirts and other things that may come from countries like China and present it as if they're made locally. How do you go around that? And also pricing and competitiveness. Because I see that there are about 85 companies big companies that are going to be involved in this, but of course, not all of them produce the same type of goods. So in terms of ensuring that there's competitiveness in terms of the pricing, how will this be determined? And finally, the issue of fronting. Large companies that can front up for small companies because they have got the ability, they've got the capital, they've got the expertise. I want to know what mechanisms are going to be put in place to control this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Chair. In fact, what I was going to ask has been largely covered by the previous colleagues who've asked questions. But I also would like to say that I think it's an excellent initiative, and we wish it every well. And I think our approach, as you've indicated, Chairperson, should be to support this in any way we can, and I think our approach will be like that. And I'd like to pick up on the point that you make under further business commitments. I don't think it has a page number, about the elimination of collusive and unethical tendencies, including when supplying government. I think this is very key. I mean, perhaps if the department could give us a little bit more detail about how they plan to prevent that, that eliminating of collusive and unethical tendencies. And then two pages later on, you talk about the labels of origin issue, which I think is very important, because we know in the past that factories have been uncovered stitching labels called proudly made in South Africa into articles that come from another country. I think one has to be extremely cautious about those sort of things, and there needs to be some kind of a watchdog that does just that. And may I just add one thing? I think that in this accord should be a line that says all South African teams, whether they be rugby or cricket or soccer, should wear South African manufactured gear. Because I once tried to procure a T-shirt for the president to wear to the Rugby World Cup, and I couldn't find one that was made in South Africa, and that's shocking.
Thanks, Madam van der Merwe. Babu Ngonyama.
No, good morning, Chair, and good morning, everybody. I must apologize that I'm late. I'm sure the Chair got my apology, Chair.
Unfortunately, we did not. we did not
okay.
yet. We did not as oh, yet
I'm,
dealt
I'm
with
sorry,
the apologies.
I,
the secretary will come back to that later.
Okay. No, thank
yeah.
you very much. The issue, Chair. Let me add my voice to the excitement about the initiative. Definitely, it is a forward movement from where we were before on the whole campaign about proudly South African and all that, which really was a bit fluffy at the time. Now we're moving towards real concrete and the programs, Chair. I really want to congratulate the department on this process. My issue is on the annual reporting. When we say there will be anniversary kind of a sort of a processes for reporting, what do we mean by that and to whom? What are the mechanisms for that, and how broad will be that process? Because we have to be very, very detailed so that everybody is mobilized to understand the impact and mobilize even other players, and that are supposed to be coming on board during that process of reporting, so that everybody understands the impact and of the program. So if we can get more on the thinking behind annual reporting. The other one is the competitiveness. To me, that's a very important area, Chairperson, because what affects decision-making by consumers is based on the quality of the product being produced, and also on the price of the product. Then it makes the consumer to make a choice whether to go local or to go and abroad. Even with regard to what has been referred to about the T-shirts, I know this is a very important issue, because even which has caused some tensions within various, even within the unions themselves, and even within political organizations. But the issue is about the price. It's about the quality of the product. Is there any mechanism in the Chair of ensuring that competitiveness is so closely monitored, so that there is no excuse by people to say that, no, I went maybe Hong Kong, or I decided to go Brazil because the price is, or because the quality is this. There must be a mechanism of doing comparisons and on the competitiveness in one way or the other, so that at the same time, consumers are not given a raw deal, Chairperson. And in other words, they are frog-marched to buy local, while at the same time, that is to their detriment. And I'm just saying that the issue of the competitiveness is a very important one. Chairperson, the pension and provident funds to promote the investment in the LP, if we can maybe get more about this, are there no sort of hindrances that people are actually moved to? Are there no regulations that actually are making people to think broad? And is it really practical that we can commit pension and provident to local procurement. Thank you.
Any other? Thank you, Babu Ngonyama, Babu Kwavaza.
Thank you, Chairperson. May I also apologize for arriving late in the meeting. I had an unexpected commitment, but here inside Parliament earlier in this morning. Chairperson, let me just start off from where Honorable Ngonyama left off with the issue of T-shirts, jackets, and other things. I do want to understand whether we intend to extend just at a specific level. I know you're talking about proudly South African. You extend this to clothing in particular. I say this because our clothing and textile industry has been very fragile, but one must acknowledge good work that has been done by EDD in stabilizing it. But one would want to say that there needs to be more done on the clothing and textile sector in this country. One at the level of ensuring that we produce our own fabric through all the value chain, starting from the cotton production and so on and so on. Are we moving towards that direction? That's number one. Number two, linked to that, I would want to suggest that we need to intensify our campaign against goods that are imported illegally into the country. And perhaps I would request a comment on that. Let me cite an example. One time I was walking in one street in Durban, I think it's Albert Street, and I saw a huge number of people, buying goods that were simply spilled out of a warehouse, a huge warehouse, into the street. You could buy the whole soccer kit for any club for 20 rand. And you could see that this is clearly not South African made and probably not legally imported. Now, are we intensifying a campaign to stop this kind of illegal importation or illegal entry of goods into the country? In addition to educating people to buy South African, one of the serious concerns about this kind of pieces of clothing, they're very cheap but also very poor quality. Compared to South African, the quality of South African clothes, it's poor quality. It lasts a couple of months and you must go back and buy again. It's just as good as going to Woolworths or in any other shop, buying a cloth that you can wear for 2 to 3 years. So that has got to be factored into, in my view, has got to be factored into this. The second clarity I seek, Chair, I realize that in the list towards the end, of identified, of designated products, you have left out the solar water heaters, which is one of the focus areas of local production and local procurement. Probably might have been left out unintentionally. Can we get clarity on that? Again, going back to the issue raised by Comrade Sue van der Merwe, the eliminating collusive and unethical tendencies. I want to specifically ask whether you are going to leave this area to the competition authorities, or is there a designated body that is going to focus on this? Because in my view, we need that. The Competition Commission has enough on its plate as we speak, and I'm not sure whether if we leave it to them, they will be able to deal with all of these extended responsibilities. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. There are questions. I think it's it's according to the time allocated. May we entertain them? May we then get responses? I don't know who's going to lead in that.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Chair, Etienne will start with the responses, and then myself and the rest of the team will come in as well.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, for the questions. Honourable Ntuli asked the question to name some of the companies who have signed on. In terms of the accord itself, it wasn't companies who signed on, but their associations or organisations. So be it Business Unity South Africa, NAFCOC, FABCOS, Business Leadership South Africa. And their members, by virtue of them signing on to the accord, their members are, of course, now included in this accord and the commitments. And we would be happy to finish the committee with lists of membership from these organizations. They're freely available on the websites of these organizations. But to give Honorable Ntuli some idea, for instance, Business Leadership South Africa, which represents the top listed companies, include the major banking and insurance groups, includes the major mining companies, industrial groups, food and beverage companies, and so on. And you know, I can we'll be happy to supply the committee with names, but it's all the kind of very well-known groups and companies that have signed on to this. The next one is Honourable Ntuli asked a question about the co-ops being given a slice of procurement, and also asking about SMEs, what is it that companies and corporates can do to assist them. So the main aim of setting up the Supplier Diversity Council was to look at procuring on the corporate side, look at procuring from not just those kind of traditional big suppliers that the corporates and companies usually procure from, but from others, such as small companies, such as cooperatives, black-owned businesses, etc., in order to spread some of the procurement and ensure some wider benefit than just the specific narrow group. And so the idea behind the Supplier Diversity Council is that business gets certain major corporates to sign on to this, that a conference and a trade or a fair is being held later in June where some of this will be publicized, some of the smaller businesses will be given an opportunity to interact with some of the larger businesses at the fair. So there's some opportunity there for smaller businesses. In terms of the cooperatives, the community constituency has given a commitment to ensure that it also works with the cooperatives, which are its members, to ensure that they are brought into the procurement supply chains, especially of larger co-ops. In terms of the setting aside a slice of the procurement, I'm not aware of what the discussion, where those discussions are at the moment, Honourable Ntuli, and if the chairperson will allow us, we will get that information for you to see what progress has been made in terms of that area. Then, Honourable Hussein asked about spoke about the outcomes being important, and then asked, had some measurement been done on what government what percentage of government procurement is local? Honourable Listen, we don't have that information, but there are some important points to make in terms of this. Firstly, that with those products that have been designated, government will procure 100% locally. So in other words, in those products that we've listed and any other products that will be added in further ways of designation, government will procure all of those products locally. In other words, there will not be discussion about a proportion or whatever, that will be 100% of that will be procured locally.
But Etienne, the question is how will that be ensured? Meaning that, do you have a plan to ensure that is done? Or is it only through triple PFA regulations that you'll ensure that done? And if compliance is not there, what then? I think if you can be able to respond to that. Because I saw that as the major concern.
Madam Chair, do you mind if I follow up on that, please, so that I can avoid a second chance? The point I wanted to make, sir, was that if you don't measure what the problem is, how do you find the solution? So it could very well be that when you come back with a report that you would say, well, actually government's procuring 100% of it. But they may have very well been procuring it all the while. Do you understand where I'm going with it? So I'm trying to understand is what is the current position or what has been the position in the past and that you're actually building on that. That's the point I wanted to make in the question.
All right.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, with regards to your clarity on the role of the regulations, within the regulations it states that once a product is designated, everything needs to be bought locally, and every tender that appears needs to include a clause that says that can only be bought locally. Then once tender bid documents are submitted, it needs to indicate where those products are manufactured and provide some details. And that gives some chance for departments to monitor it. Now, it still doesn't mean that there cannot be some way that in certain cases that cannot be done, and that is where, you know, ourselves in monitoring this agreement would need to play some role and together with other government departments that oversee, for instance, the procurement regulations. So, and then in terms of the point that the Honourable Hussein makes about, you know, what is the current situation? I don't have the individual information per products, but in some of the sectors we found that in the past there's been designation taking place, especially in the clothing and textile sector, and that designation has been implemented especially at the national government level, but not so much at the provincial and municipal level. And what this procurement regulations now do for the first time is ensure that right through in all three spheres of government, but also in the state-owned companies, that is a prerequisite. With regards to the Honourable Hussein spoke about or gave the example of the T-shirts and how to tighten up the monitoring and measuring there. Once again, it's the same situation. What is clothing has been designated as one of the sectors, which would include T-shirts then. That would mean that all provincial government, municipalities, national government, and state-owned companies would need to buy those locally when they do. But what has been added to the procurement accord now is that trade unions, as well as business organizations, as well as community organizations, have committed themselves to procure this product and a couple of similar products exclusively locally. Then the Honourable Hussein, Comrade Chairperson, also asked about proudly South African and not doing enough work on the demand side. The commitments that proudly South African has made is significant in that it focuses almost exclusively on the demand side. It says firstly that it will run a buy local campaign, in other words, educating consumers about the benefits of procuring local products and what that means in terms of job creation, what that means in terms of building industry, dealing with poverty. But as I've mentioned also, importantly, with another campaign which also focuses on the demand side is the Label of Origin campaign, where it educates consumers about how they can get more information about the Label of Origin. So it's shifted this work from Proud of South African very much to focus on the demand side in order to ensure that we have increased demand for locally manufactured products. Then with regards to the question on the rural economy benefiting from this and the Rural Development Department not being a signatory, our acting DG will deal with that question, Honourable Chairperson. And then a couple of questions have been asked to specifically around corruption and the tendering process and so on. One of the main parts of the one of the main reasons that new tender or new procurement regulations have been implemented is not just to deal with local procurement, but also to ensure that one deals with things like fronting, with corruption, etc. And it's important that when these are now implemented, that it's properly monitored to ensure that we deal with these measures. Now, in terms of the competitiveness, we also ask, what is it that is being done to deal with the competitiveness? Because it's fine to deal with the demand side, but you also need to look at the competitiveness. In the past 2 or so years, the Department of Trade and Industry and other parts of government have implemented several programs to deal with competitiveness, and these include new incentives. These include some new loans, preferential loans by the IDC. And the idea with these was to link those incentives and those loans to the increase in competitiveness by the recipients, specifically the companies and the manufacturers that receive them. And for that reason, in the presentation, we said that there's it's important that we not just look at increasing the demand for locally produced products, but that we also strengthen the competitiveness of those companies. And that's what the incentives and the recently announced incentives for the broader manufacturing sector by the Minister of Trade and Industry aims to do. Then, Honourable Van der Merwe asked some questions around the label of origin and stitching it into garments, and how do we monitor that? The label of origin, specifically in the clothing and textile sector, has been implemented in terms of regulations, in terms of the Merchandise Marks Act, which gives government some powers to fine companies and those companies who especially remove labels and stitching new labels. The new Consumer Commission has been given the work by the DTI to ensure that it does the monitoring of this. It monitors the use of the label of origin and any possible problems with that. Then the Honourable Ngonyama asked a question about the annual reporting and how that will be done, and what are the mechanisms for monitoring this. Once the parties sit down in June with a report back in the high-level task team, this is one of the things we would need to decide on and figure out, is how do we publicize the positive procurement stories that are coming out of this process and the impact in terms of job creation, in terms of poverty alleviation that this change in procurement is bringing about. And then the Honourable Ngonyama also asked a question about pension and provident funds, whether there aren't any regulations and how practical it is. These were commitments, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Ngonyama, made by in the case by the trade unions, who would have had some idea of the constraints that they fall under in terms of using their retirement funds to implement this. And the fact that they have made these commitments, you know, to us is an indication that they feel comfortable that this is something that can be done. Finally, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Kwabasa asked the questions around a couple of questions around the clothing and textile sector. Firstly, the clothing and textile sector is one of the sectors that have been designated, which means that where tenders appear, where government departments, be it correctional services looking for prison uniforms or hospitals looking for bed linen, that these need to be bought from local manufacturers. importantly, in terms of promoting the textile sector on the Book of Basa, because textiles are designated, it means that when you manufacture a uniform for a prisoner, that the fabric also needs to be made locally if that fabric is available, and we see this as also a boost for the local textile sector. And you spoke about the importance of weaving and knitting fabrics locally. Then beyond the government making a commitment in terms of designating these sectors, the different business associations, trade unions, and community organizations have also committed that specifically on T-shirts, jackets, tracksuits, some of these kind of promotional items, that these would also be manufactured locally, which we think is also an important part of assisting the local clothing manufacturing sector. Honorable Kobasa, with regards to the solar water heaters, the acting DG will deal with that question. And Honorable Chair, I think that covers the questions that have been asked.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flock, DG.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members. The question around the rural development not being a signatory to the accord. Chairperson, I think the important issue to understand is that whilst the signing of the accord was led by the Economic Development Department, Department of Trade and Industry, National Treasury, and the other government signatories to this accord. For example, energy and public enterprises were also signatories. This, the ministers designated to sign this accord has done so on behalf of government. So all government departments are committed and party to this accord and are bound by this accord. And so whilst those ministers might not have signed the actual accord, the ministers and deputy ministers who signed it were designated by government to do that on behalf of government. So the issue of how this will impact on the rural economy and on rural communities is an important one and has clearly been factored into the process. It's something which we need to look at how do we practically implement that, and we can come back to the committee on that. The second issue which has been raised by the Honourable Ms. van der Merwe is around our South African sporting teams. I think as government we concur with that, and I think just recently we had the whole furore over the Olympic team. And in terms of the local procurement accord and the designation of clothing and textiles, we are calling on the people of South Africa, whether it's business, government, community stakeholders, including sporting bodies, to commit to buying local in terms of clothing and textile products. So we support the view that you've outlined there. In terms of the illegal imports and the campaign to stop the illegal importation of goods, TTI is leading that campaign and process with the support of National Treasury, EDD, and other departments. And as government, we support that. The question raised by the Honorable Kabasa around solar water heaters not being included, and maybe it's an oversight. Honourable members, not an oversight. The designation of renewable energy and renewable energy products such as solar water heaters will be included in the next phase of designations, which will happen shortly. As we've indicated, this is being led by the Department of Trade and Industry. And in relation to solar water heaters, they have set up a team at the DTI to look at the specifications for solar water heaters. They looking at the question of locally manufactured products and how they can designate that. And the SABS is part of that team working with DTI to specifically look at the designation of solar water heaters. Chair, I think that's covered the other outstanding issues. I don't know if any of my colleagues want to come in at this point.
Thank you very much. Did you any other response from any member of the team? Okay. Thank you very much. I think for the responses, actually, we really appreciate that. I think this accord really calls upon all of us to support it and make sure that we play our roles, individual roles in publicizing and also in monitoring its implementation for it to be successful. It's our accord. It's doing South Africa good. Actually, it's going to benefit all of us. So it is important that we support it and not just support verbally, but also in our actions and also educate those who are not aware of its importance and participate also in proudly South African issues. I think what we need to get more from yourself, DG, before you leave, just a minute, the state of readiness, because you put timeline 75%, but 75%, what is the timeline for that? Because it's quite a big percentage. Of course, the public and the private sector will be procuring locally, you know. But it doesn't really give us the breakage. Up to when are you intending to do that? What time frames have you given yourself to do that? Is it a 3-5 year, you know, a commitment? What is it? We need to understand that. And then I'm also hoping that the progress will be reported through your quarterly reports, because especially over that the first meeting is in June. So the outcome of that meeting will be also put as in a way of a report, in a form of a report, quarterly report to us. We will appreciate that if we can, if you can. So thank you very much otherwise for the presentation, which was very well done, and for the responses provided. I hope that members are more enriched and more informed now, knowledgeable about this accord. Can we just allow you to move out 2 minutes, and then, but your other members of the delegation, DG, will be here, and then we give space for Competition Commission to brief us.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Come again. Yeah, if we can have to cool for some time now. We're happy that you are still fit and yourself. Can we then resume our meeting? Come back to our meeting. Again, we have Competition Commission presentation. I guess there are new faces that would need to be introduced to them, to the members. And I also realize there are new members that need to be introduced to the commission, especially the new members of the, to the new members in the commission that do not know. I don't know where to start. Or let me start by introducing members of the committee first. I'll start at up there, the far further side, which is Mr. Ngonyama. Mr. Ngonyama is representing COPE in the committee. Not for long, though. Oh, that was on a lighter note. We have Mayor Mohorosi, who's representing the ANC in the committee. We have the gentleman with an orange, what do you call that? Okay, and the red tie, maroon tie, I think, or red or maroon. Mr. Kwabaza, representing the ANC. And then we have Mr. Mubu, who's wearing earthly colors. Mubu Gasutu ke Mubu, soil. So you represent that in your clothing today, your attire today. He's representing, no, it's because, you know, you don't look like you belong there. Anyway, he's representing the DA. We have next to him Mr. Ntuli, who's also the whip of the committee. And then next to Mr. Ntuli we have Madame van der Merwe, representing the ANC. Together with Mr. Ntuli, they're representing the ANC. And then we have our researcher here, Ms. Mbelekana Nwabisa. And then we have the committee secretary, Ms. Skak Tando. And then we have the committee assistant. Yeah. I'm given the surname now, Mr. Mtonjeni. I understand it's C.M. Mtonjeni. Okay. They change from time to time. We don't have a dedicated committee assistant. So they change from time to time. That's why we have to get the names first. So Mtonjeni is today our committee assistant. We also have the PMG from Parliament, and then I think we also have members of the media. We have our usual guests here who really support the committee meetings, and they just make follow-ups, and they follow the deliberations in the committee and then come back to communicate with us and give us feedback. We have lots of them here, so we really appreciate your attendance. And the media, of course. May I then hand over to you, Mr. Ramburu, for the introduction and the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, honorable members. If I can first thank you very much for the interest you've shown in our work and the opportunity to discuss progress on issues that we've speaked to you about at an earlier time. The delegation from the Competition Commission to my right is Trudy Makaya. She has recently been appointed as the Divisional Manager for our Advocacy and Stakeholder Relations Division. On my right is Tembing Kosi Bonakele, who's the Deputy Commissioner and who you are familiar with. And Itebogeng is sitting next to Paul. She is from our Advocacy and Stakeholder Relations Division. Chair, in response to the letter you sent us inviting us to make...
Now, can I correct that and then begin by... can I correct myself and begin by getting... Sorry, Mr. Ramburu, for that interruption. Requesting the secretary to give us the apologies. Because earlier on we had to start without the recognizing apologies for today. I did apologize on behalf of the minister and the DG. Can you give us other apologies, please?
Good morning, honorable members, and good morning to everyone. I've got three apologies. The first apology is from Honorable Sotetsi. She apologized that she won't be able to attend the meeting due to the fact that she has been put on the task team organizing the funeral of the late Honorable Shitreka. Also, Honorable Mabasa, he has been also put on that task team. And the third apology is from Honorable Singh. He apologized that he won't be able to attend the meeting due to prior commitments. The other apology that I heard was from another Bungonyama. He apologized that he was going to attend late. He was going to arrive late. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we need a written apology from Mr. Singh. We recognize the fact that he's a full member of the Public Accounts Committee also. So public accounts meet every day. So sometimes he because there are very few in the IFP also, they have to attend all other meetings. We recognize that fact, but at the same time would like to get a record. In relation to your presentation, we have requested that you give us firstly the progress in terms of the ruling by the appeals court, that is the implementation progress in terms of implementation of the outcomes of that court appeal, the court outcome, you had also, as the Competition Commission, appeal or filed an application to the Constitutional Court. Last time you gave us that briefing, we needed to get a follow-up and get updated on how far you with that, what was the ruling, and that's apart from what we hear from the media, because we don't want to hear anything from the media, we want to hear from yourself. Also, the Pioneer Food case, there was an outcome in terms of the issues related to the bread, and we just want to understand, how are you monitoring the implementation of this outcome? Whether you have any strategies in place to ensure that you monitor and evaluate progress in terms of implementation of those outcomes. This might be just few of the outcomes that we're referring to, but there are many others that we haven't even referred to here. So we just want you to give us that. Earlier on, we had a presentation from the department on the local procurement. We just want to know, how does that, this work of yours impact on the local procurement issues and help in promoting, the work of the local business. But apart from that, not just that, but issues of impact positively, I think, on the consumers actually, because that's what we're interested in, so that we protect the consumers from unfair practices. And also pricing to us is very important. We also requested you, or you may add anything that you feel is very important or you'd want to the members to be aware of, something that we might not even have noted in our request for you to appear before the committee on. So we'll appreciate any other information that is valuable, that can be valuable to us. And as we indicated before, our meetings with you are mainly to ensure that we are more aware, knowledgeable of the issues that you are dealing with, the intention of supporting, and also making sure that. And the support comes in various ways. We spread the information that we get, we assess, we have our constituencies, we go there, we check whether your work does impact. And as you heard from our previous meetings, we do give you feedback on some of the issues and would obviously want to see how effectively those issues that you're raising are implemented. It is important, especially at this time of the in this period wherein we want to see progress being made, especially in developing small and medium enterprises, included in that is our cooperatives. We want to see that because we're interested in issues of jobs. We need to see more jobs being created. We want to see growth as much as development, because to us it's not just about growth, it's about development. We want to see the poorest of the poor at least being able to put bread on the table. That's what we need, and that your mandate as per the Competition Act gives you an opportunity to make changes in as far as the issues that are confronting the country are concerned, especially around the business areas. So may I then hand over to you to give us your presentation, Mr. Rambarot.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in response to the issues that you outlined in your letter to us, I've broken down this presentation into four distinct parts, and I'm happy to go through it all and take questions in the end or to stop after each part. You must guide me on that. Some of these issues are interrelated, but we can take them one at a time as well because they are somewhat different issues from each other. So the first, this is a slide that's showing the different outline, the outline of this presentation. I must just add, in addition to this, we've put on a stiffy disk all the original articles and judgments relating to all of these cases for the members' benefit. A lot of these issues, as they come out of courts, are sometimes open to interpretation and sometimes even to spin and public relations. And we'd also like you to have a look at the original documents to get a sense of what they say. So the first of these issues you asked us to address is the Competition Court ruling on Walmart and Massmart. This has had a very long history, which you're all familiar with, and has been widely reported in the newspaper. It's a very controversial matter in which both government departments, three of them, and trade unions and representatives of small businesses participated in the tribunal proceedings on this matter, and essentially were not altogether happy with the Commission having approved this merger on competition grounds. The Commission found there were no competition issues here, but parties raised a number of public interest issues that they wanted to be taken into account, and they wanted more weight to be given to in the decision making. So I've just, to cut everything short and not go through detail, I've just put up a slide looking at just the differences between what the tribunal decided on this matter and what the Competition Appeal Court decided on this matter. You recall that here there was both a review and an appeal. A review was by the government departments, and they were saying that they didn't have the time and the opportunity and the access to sufficient information and documents to make a meaningful input, and therefore the process was unfair to them. That matter was thrown out. It was the appeal was dismissed by the court, the review application. Essentially, the court found that those parties had indeed reasonable time and opportunity to make inputs into the proceedings. The appeal itself, this was mostly pursued by the unions, was held in part and not in part. So this slide shows you the difference between what the tribunal held and what the Competition Appeal Court held. Essentially, the tribunal, following all the issues that were raised in the tribunal hearing, Walmart and Massmart volunteered a set of conditions based on what issues were emerging from the hearing, and the tribunal adopted these and made them an order of the tribunal. And there were four parts to these. And it was this order of the tribunal that went to the Competition Appeal Court for this review and appeal now. So the first of these was related to a cap on retrenchments. tribunal said that the merged entity would not retain workers for a period of 2 years. This was upheld by the appeal court. It didn't change that ruling. The second was there was a controversy over whether 503 workers who were retrenched during June 2010. This was way before the time that the merger was notified to us as the authorities, whether that retrenchment way back a year or so before it came to us, 6 months or so before it came to us, whether that was a merger-specific retrenchment or whether that retrenchment had nothing to do with the merger, because if something is merger-specific, you need to take that into account as something that results from that merger. Merger specificity, and I'll talk a little bit about this, is a very important principle in our work. We can only address things that, when we're deciding on a merger, that arises out of that merger. You know, if merger is between two parties and it's in a particular industry, we can't go and take decisions relating to other parties in other industries. Our decisions must be specifically related to the transaction we are approving. So the question here was whether these retrenchments were specific to this merger or whether they had nothing to do with the merger. The parties were saying they had nothing to do with the merger. The unions were saying, look, these guys were preparing these firms for the takeover, and hence these retrenchments occurred. And the difference here between this between the two orders is, whereas the tribunal said, well, these 503 workers, you must give them preferential employment opportunities. If they come to you for work in the future, you must favor them as opposed to other people who hadn't worked for you before. So it was preferential employment by the tribunal, whereas the Competition Appeal Court changed that because it was persuaded that these were indeed merger-specific, and it said that all of these 503 retrenched workers ought to be reinstated. So that's the one difference. On the third order of the tribunal, this was ordering the merging parties to honor all existing labor agreements it has with existing unions, in this case SACAWU, for a period of 3 years. This is for purposes of collective bargaining. That was in fact retained by the appeal court. There was no change with respect to that. And then the fourth ruling of the tribunal, this was perhaps the most controversial area in the hearings. This had to do with setting up a competitiveness fund to support local suppliers and small businesses. And Walmart had volunteered 100 million rand to set this up. Essentially, this was a fund that would assist local suppliers to improve logistics in the value chain. That was accepted by the tribunal. But at the Competition Appeal Court, the appeal court said that not enough had been done to understand these global value chain and their impact and implications off this merger on those global value chains and on local manufacturing. And the court ordered that a committee of experts, one person each from the merging parties, from government and from the unions, should get together, examine the implications of this merger on the global value chain, and out of that get a better understanding of what it is exactly this fund will do and give more meat to how this fund will operate. So the difference between the two is, whereas the tribunal was happy to say, look, go and sort it out and report to the commission on how you're doing it, the court is saying, no, you go, get your experts together, come back and tell me what the plan is, and the court will then now endorse this plan going forward. A period of 3 months has been given for this to happen, and it is currently work in progress. Okay, so that's essentially where we're at right now. I should just say a few more things with respect. respect to perhaps what was the most...
When you say work in progress, what do you mean?
Well, my understanding is that the experts have been appointed. They have had held meetings with each other. And I think 3 months, I think we're only halfway or less than halfway into those 3 months. They will thereafter report back to the court on their findings, and that condition will be tightened up on the basis of that.
So when is the due date for reporting?
I'm not sure exactly what the date is. This is, you must understand, doesn't include
I
the
understand.
Commission at all. It's the one each of the parties, and so I'm not sure what the dates are for that. But they should be in the next 6 weeks or so. That their work should finish. So the big issue that came out of this case, I should say that notwithstanding this additional now loop around refining what this fund does, this merger is now approved. Okay, the legal status here is the merger is approved. The big issue that came out here is about the global value chain and local manufacturing and lots of fears being expressed in the course of our hearings and submissions that a company as big and sophisticated as Walmart, with its very sophisticated procurement and supply chain management, would be able to procure very cheap products from elsewhere in the world, thereby undermining South Africa's manufacturers, worst-case scenario resulting in the South African manufacturing not being able to develop, which is one of the major objectives of government around job creation and value and producing value-added products. The commission did look into this matter and investigated it, and essentially what our merger investigation found, once again, we had to show what the difference in procurement practices were before the merger and after the merger, specific to the merger. Once again, the question of merger specificity comes in. So we said, well, let's look at before the merger, to what extent are South African retailers importing and to what extent are they buying locally? And then we'll look at the current situation and we'll compare it to what would happen post-merger when Walmart entered the country. Now, our investigations found that already, before Walmart entering the country, there are very high levels of imports from our local retailers from elsewhere in the world. So, and we found that the difference when Walmart would come in wouldn't be a significant difference in terms of the importing pattern. And so, on those grounds in kind of competition law and merger analysis, because the pre- and post-merger situation don't differ significantly, those are not valid grounds to base a decision to base an adverse decision on. And here, the Commission is very concerned that, I mean, there's a bigger problem here. The Commission is concerned that South African manufacturing is not internationally competitive. But, you know, we need to look at the reasons why this is the case. Certainly, you know, policymakers everywhere in time and elsewhere in the world would say, well, let's kind of protect our local guys for a while until they get off their feet and become more competitive, and then we'll open them up to international competition thereafter. But I don't think there's any policymakers in this time, at least, who feel that it's a permanent solution to keep away competition from elsewhere in the world and protect your local people and give them preferences forever. I mean, the point of policy is to make your local manufacturers competitive, give them the ability to stand on their own feet and be able to compete with the rest of the world. So we've looked at this issue, not only in the context of this case, but it's an issue that emerges in a number of cases that we have. And the one thing I'd like to highlight here, because it's a very current case that we have a case currently against Sasol in the polyurethane market. Polymers. Essentially, polymers are used essentially to make plastic. From the plastic, you make buckets, plastic buckets, you know, rulers, kids use in school, those pencil cases, lunch boxes, those kinds of things that are made out of this. And in this case, what the issue here is that Sasol is the dominant supplier of this product that makes the results in this, of this polymer that results in these plastic products. And in the case that we have against Sasol for monopoly pricing, for pricing these products at monopoly prices, the raw material. And so, you know, firms in the plastic sector, we've interviewed them for this case, they are saying that the main reason they are unable to manufacture these lunch boxes and rulers and buckets locally is because the cost of the input from Sasol is so high. Okay? So now imagine a situation where we would be saying to a retailer that you must only buy your buckets and your rulers and your lunch boxes from local manufacturers. What will then happen is local manufacturers will produce this product at a much higher cost than it would be able to be got internationally. And that higher amount essentially will go to subsidizing Sasol. So Sasol will end up being the main beneficiary here because it is charging these excessive prices for the polymer that is used to make buckets and rulers. And I think that, you know, the point this is a far more effective way of using competition law and competition policy to address this issue. Because if we can get one of the ways in which we can make South African firms more competitive and give them the ability to compete in the international market is to ensure that monopolistic firms within our economy are not charging excessive prices for the inputs into manufacturing. Indeed, this is, and in many presentations we've made to you before, one of the central organizing principles around how we prioritize our work in the Commission. One of the principles is we must look at those markets that are inputs, that provide inputs into manufacturing and ensure that those manufacturing inputs, the prices thereof are not too excessive and enables a manufacturing sector to develop. Those are the points I think to make just on that first issue. I want to move on to the constitutional court issues, but I'm happy to take questions at this point. In your hands.
I think you should continue with the presentation and we'll ask questions after.
Okay.
Just indicate the question that you've asked is by when should the committee of experts submit their report. In terms of the judgment, they should do so within 3 months of the judgment. Mm-hmm. I just thought I should bring that to your attention. Within 3 months of the judgment.
Judgment was when, and when is the end of that 3 months?
I don't know what. Okay, we just need to work out 3 months from the date of the judgment, and I'm not sure what the date of the judgment is.
Okay, you may continue while they're looking at that.
Okay, so the constitutional court cases. Okay, this is now a completely different issue. The best way for me to explain all of this and to start is start off by getting an understanding of what the legal process in competition enforcement is. This is important to understand because we have three cases at the Constitutional Court relating to this issue. So, and you'll see how it fits together. But essentially, in the competition authorities, you first would have somebody, either a government department or a firm or an individual or anybody, will complain to the commission. There's a complaint. Following the complaint, the commission will investigate, and it will either non-refer the matter, which is to say that it will find there's no problem here, there's not a competition issue, there's no jurisdiction, this matter we're not going to proceed with, we're not going to pursue, which is the non-refer, or it will refer it upon concluding its investigation, it will decide there is a case to be made here, it will refer the case to the competition tribunal, which essentially now will be the court of first instance. It's the adjudicative body that will listen to us as the prosecutors, but it will also listen to all the other parties that have anything to do with this case, all the respondents and any other interested parties. It will listen to everybody, and then at a hearing that is public, and thereafter take a decision. Okay? So I've also made the slide with different colors representing different institutions. Okay, so there's a tribunal hearing and there's a tribunal decision. If somebody's not happy with the tribunal decision, they can take it to the Competition Appeal Court and either appeal or review it. Although the legislation didn't envisage this, the next step from the Competition Appeal Court, if you're not happy with its decision, is to take it to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And then, of course, all decisions can ultimately be taken to the Constitutional Court in a constitutional matter. Okay? I think the important thing when one looks at the diagram like this, or when one looks at the process, is to appreciate how legal intensive these processes are. That they're not, that although one of the big controversies we've had is how informal and what level of formality you need to have here. And, of course, the hearings are not as formal as in a courtroom. But nonetheless, the rules of legal processes apply and the standards of legal processes apply as you go through these hierarchy of institutions. Okay, to summarize then, these three cases that we've taken in the competition to the Competition Appeal Court have to do with the process. And the idea that began winning currency, that first the Supreme Court of Appeal and then the Competition Appeal Court began accepting, is the idea that in every step of this process there must be symmetry. Okay, this is the important concept. Symmetry here means that whatever was, to put it crudely, whatever was complained of, and whoever it was complained against, that is the only thing the commission can investigate. Okay, in other words, if somebody complained that persons A and B was involved in collusion in a particular market, the commission can only investigate A and B, and it can only investigate them for collusion. It can't investigate them from any other practice, and it can't investigate anybody else. Only those two for the particular thing that was complained of, right? So that would be a symmetry between the complaint and an investigation. But the sum total of what happened that the courts began doing is they began taking it through the entire process, and they're saying at each level you must stick to what was complained of. You can't go any broader. You know, if X was complained of, you only investigate X. You can only refer X to the tribunal. The tribunal can only take a decision on X, and they can't look beyond that which has been complained of. And essentially, that is the basic principle of all the cases we've taken to the Constitutional Court. Okay, so I'm going to take them one at a time now, and we look at them. But this is an important conceptual thing to understand, the idea that there's symmetry between the complaint, the investigation, the referral, and the tribunal decision, both in terms of the content, in other words, what they have been accused of and under which section of the act they've been accused of it, and in terms of who has been accused. So in know, if you only accuse A and B, you can't bring in C later on. I'm simplifying it. The detail is in each of the cases. Okay, so now, all our trouble started when the Supreme Court of Appeal took a decision in a case against Woodlands Dairy in a milk cartel that we were investigating. I should point out this is a known cartel. It's been known for a very long time. It operated in a market with very complex relationships between farmers who were the producers of the milk and dairies who were the processors of the milk, and there were all sorts of arrangements around pricing, dairies both imposing prices on farmers on the one hand and the supermarkets on the other, and on supply, and there were kind of mechanisms to restrict supply, etc. But none of these content matters went anywhere because we got in this case, we were plagued by procedural challenges every step of the way. And eventually, and I must say in this matter, after having won this point at the tribunal, after having won it at the Competition Appeal Court, it went to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and here they took a decision that in effect restricted the Commission's powers to initiate, investigate, and ultimately prosecute complaints. Okay? The argument they made goes something like this. Essentially, they argued that because the administrative penalties of the commission, levied by the commission, are so high and resemble criminal penalties, the standards, the procedural standards, should be closer to criminal standards than to administrative law standards. That was the first big point in principle that they made. And they said further, the commission must have a reasonable suspicion to initiate against very specific individuals. They can't say we are investigating this whole market or this whole sector, which was in fact what we did in the instance of milk. We thought an investigation into the entire industry was appropriate, and they thought it was inappropriate. You should be listing each person. And thirdly, they said that the point I made earlier, whatever is complained of, that defines the scope of the investigation and referral. Whatever is complained of, you can't go beyond that in terms of what you're investigating and what you refer. And they said if there's new information that comes in the course of your investigation, the commission can amend its complaint, which is just an administrative signing of a piece of paper saying I hereby amend the complaint, or initiate a new complaint with new information. Okay? So this was a decision that essentially opened the door for, you know, this decision dealt with the first part of this process from complaint to investigation. Okay? And then people began taking that same point in various different points in this a workflow diagram on the legal process of the competition enforcement. And so relying on this decision, we got a number of other applications challenging jurisdiction to investigate and prosecute them by saying, you know, what was done in the step earlier is inconsistent with what is happening now. This made it very difficult for the commission to investigate because an investigation by its very nature is where you get new information all the time and have to interact with that new information. And one of the implications here is that we could not use information that was not relevant to what we set out to do to start off with. Okay, so this caused problems, but this was not a case at that point. Because the court said, well, we could amend every time we got new information, we thought, as an agency, perhaps we could live with this, and we didn't really appeal this matter. Okay? But the point here is that the effect of this decision was that this case we had against the remote cartel had to stop. It ceased. We can't proceed with it anymore. That was the end of the case. And this was after a lot of work and energy was put into investigating this matter. We had to abandon it because there was this procedural defect. What happened next was this Competition Appeal Court, after this Woodlands decision, then took a decision in a case involving Yara in the fertilizer industry. And here, this is a case around Sasol, who essentially supplies Yara and Omnia, two competitors, with ammonia for the production of fertilizer. Ammonia is one of the three basic ingredients of fertilizer, the other being ammonia provides the nitrogen, and then phosphorus and potassium and are the other two elements, and fertilizer is essentially a blend between these three chemicals, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and Yara and Omnia were blenders, and Sasol was supplying firms. Nutriflow was also being supplied by Sasol, complained to us that this ammonia was excessively priced. And we accepted this, and in the course of our investigation, it turns out that, you know, Sasol is dominant in this market, and one of the ways in which it retains its dominant power is by being organized in a cartel with Omnia and Yara to in a committee that they called the Nitrogen Balancing Committee that restricted imports and restricted outputs of fertilizer in the fertilizer market. They restricted the imports of nitrogen and affected the quantities of in production and supply of fertilizer. And Sasol confirmed with us that this cartel existed and settled with the commission, paid a fine on that here was a cartel, they agreed, and they paid a fine on it. But the other two companies, Yara and Omnia, then made the argument that, look, Nutriflow only complained of an excessive pricing by Sasol. They didn't complain of a cartel. And according to this principle that's come out, the commission therefore can only investigate the excessive pricing case because the complaint was only made of excessive pricing. Why is the commission now kind of making findings on the existence of a cartel that wasn't complained of at all? And the CAC, working off the Woodlands decision, agreed with this point and said that the commission's powers of investigation was restricted to the excessive pricing case and it had no business going beyond that investigating a cartel. Now remember, Sasol has agreed that this cartel exists and has paid a fine for it. But the court is saying because the complaint was only about dominance and excessive pricing, we couldn't investigate the existence of a cartel. Okay, so this is not beginning to make sense to us as an investigating body because we're finding things and the rules are making it difficult for us to act on it. Then, to make matters worse, there's a further case. The next case was Loungeville. Okay, so this is a matter, this is foam. This is the market for foam that is used to make mattresses. Okay, and in this, using the same principles as before, the CAC found that it must restrict its investigation only to the parties that were complained of. If A and B were complained of, you can't investigate C. The commission can only investigate the conduct that was complained of and can't refer anything beyond that it found in the course of its investigation. And to make matters worse, whereas the previous decision said we could amend our complaint as we got new information. This decision of the CAC said we couldn't even amend our complaint. In other words, whatever the complaint referral was initially, you need to stick to that. You couldn't even amend it. You need to start new investigations for everything rather than this amend the existing one. And we have applied for, and so it is these, essentially, these two decisions, the Yara decision and the Loungeville decision that are in, that we've taken to the Constitutional Court for clarity on the scope and ambit to initiate and investigate and refer complaints, and we are still awaiting the outcome of the competition of the Constitutional Court on these two matters. The third matter that we took to Constitutional Court regarding Senbev is one in which the Quan Court has delivered its decision already. Okay, so we've got out of the three cases, we've got one of them, a decision coming out already, which is Senbev. The other two we're still waiting for. And what happens in Senbev has more to do with the power of the tribunal to take, to make findings on issues that were not referred to it. Okay, so the story here is Senbev is a company that operates silos, would store the grain, but Senbev as a company is also a grain trader. It trades grain in the grain market, and it was charging different prices for the storage of grain in its silos between the customers it traded for and the customers it didn't trade for. Okay, in other words, if you had maize and you went to Senbev and said, look, store this for me, but you can't sell it, they charge you a different price to somebody who said, store this for me, and you can't trade it for me. You can't sell it for me. Okay? And the commission started this case by making an accusation, if you like, of exclusionary conduct and price discrimination under Section 8C of the Act, which prevents a dominant firm for exclusionary conduct and price discrimination. Those are the words of the Act. But in the course of the hearing, the economists, our economists actually, introduced the concept of a margin squeeze, which is just another economic concept to say, well, what they were doing is they were kind of, you know, decreasing the margins to the extent that you were squeezing people out of the market, which, you know, is that the same as an exclusionary conduct? Is that the same as a price discrimination? What was happening in this case is that the SEA said that because the concept of margin squeeze, the words margin squeeze, those two words, were not mentioned in the initial initiation, they were not concepts that were used when we started the case. Therefore, they argue, the tribunal couldn't make a finding on margin squeeze because the parties didn't know up front that the case that they were having to participate in had to do with something called margin squeeze. This came up in the course of the hearing. So this is now, and so they set out, so the SEA said, therefore, this is a case that we're throwing out, abandon the case. So we were left with having to give up this case on the grounds of this argument because we didn't use the words margin squeeze and because we said it was exclusionary conduct and price discrimination. This was unfair to the parties concerned because its fairness requires the accused to know exactly what case they have to meet. Now, the decision short and sweet, we won this case at the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court reversed the decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal. They found all the semantics around, you know, these concepts and academic concepts of exclusionary conduct and market squeeze, margin squeeze, they found it to be a red herring. And, you know, the general principle is that you kind of can't always very neatly pigeonhole real life behavior into neat conceptual categories of economics. You know, it's these are kind of, you know, the real life, what's happening in real life doesn't always fit into very neat categories. They said as long as an argument was still made on the basis of 8C, which it was, Marvin's squeeze was made on the basis of 8C of the Act, this is valid. It's valid to proceed with this case. So this is a very enabling decision for us at the Commission and the Tribunal, indeed, because it affirms our approach around how we deal. You know, that you don't kind of pigeonhole up front, that it's the investigation that reveals what has really happened. And it allows us to interpret legislation against our objectives and the bigger picture rather than narrowly interpreting procedural points in very narrow ways. And it's essentially making an important point that says, you know, procedural errors can be fixed without causing unfairness to any party. In other words, even if there was a procedural error here, you know, fix the error and get on with it, but don't throw out the whole case because of a procedural error, I think essentially is the sentiment. Now, the interesting thing about this is that this section of the Act, 8C, doesn't carry an administrative fine, a penalty on the first offense.
Sorry, Mr. Ambrose, I'm just worried about time.
Sure.
Because you must still give members an opportunity to ask questions and yourself to respond again. So if you can just speed up a bit.
I will, thanks. Okay, so Section 8C doesn't have a penalty for the first offense. For the second offense, yes. But we do have the powers to impose remedies, to remedy the situation that we found that was anti-competitive. And now that this case has been decided at the Constitutional Court, the next steps are for CENVES for us to meet with CENVES and determine remedies, which we will then take to the tribunal to be made a tribunal order. Okay, the third of our issues then is Pioneer Food Price Reduction Remedy. The history here, you'll recall, was that start with the bread cartel where Tiger Brand settled with us. Pioneer Foods, Premier Foods was the corporate leniency applicant and didn't get fined. But Pioneer Foods challenged us and went all the way to the Competition Appeal Court challenging our case and ultimately lost it, and then came to the table to settle this and many other matters they had before us. Because we're dealing with a whole bunch of different cases here, we put together a settlement that became the order of the tribunal that had essentially five elements to it. Firstly, it required that the party stop the offensive behavior and put in place a compliance program. They had to then pay a fine of 500 million rand, an administrative penalty, which is a penalty in the normal course that goes to the National Revenue Fund. But then in addition to that, they had to put together, there was an additional amount of 250 million rand that they had to make available to set up an agro-processing competitiveness fund, which would be administered by the IDC. The IDC, I know, reported on this when they went last before the committee. And then the thing that this committee wants to know about is they have to adjust their prices so that they forego profits of 160 million rand by putting that money essentially back into the pockets of consumers. And finally, they committed to increase their investment by a further 150 million rand to what they previously had planned to do. So this was a whole package of conditions that was placed on this firm as part of the settlement agreement we had, and the one that you were particularly interested in was the one that had to do with the pricing remedy. So here, as you know, it's very rare, and the competition authorities, know, one of the kind of principles upon which they work on is they very rarely set a price. I mean, pricing remedy is a very rare thing. Competition authorities don't say this is the rand and cent amount that something would be. They will influence the price, but they don't set one. Okay? So in that spirit, what this remedy was about is it was, we looked at the profits that this company made in the previous year, and we said, you need to cut those profits by 160 million rand. And how that will happen is that you will reduce the price of bread and flour, certain categories thereof, you know, the standard government loaf of bread, not all different, all the different and standard flour. You will reduce the price up to 160 million rand. So in other words, the price came down when they lost in inverted commas their profits in inverted commas of 160 million rand. They took the price theoretically back to where it otherwise would have been. Okay, all of this occurred during December 2010 and January 2011. It occurred in that kind of 2 month period, perhaps going on a little bit till February. Now, the general question that got asked is that, and this has happened already, that previous thing has happened. Now the question is, well, what impact has this had in the market? Has the price of bread come down? Well, I mean, you know, firstly, like all food products and most internationally traded products, there are very kind of complex reasons why prices go up and down. There's just not one thing causing it. There's a whole, you know, prices in the world over food are going up for a variety of different reasons and for different reasons in different regional areas. And the fact that grain is a commodity is it's kind of subject to the kind of the ups and downs of the global commodity markets. And if you think about what your biggest inputs are in making bread, your biggest inputs is oven, which means you need electricity and you need transport to distribute it to wherever you're distributing it. And of course, fuel and electricity pricing has a big impact on the price of bread and, you know, its contribution to the price as opposed to our intervention is something that's not always easy to work out. However, there are indications of the emergence of a rivalry in the bread market, and I mean, if you go to your local pick and pay, you should be able to see this, that whereas in the previous time, bread prices were pretty much the same across the board. I mean, in the previous time, before our case, if you went to your local garage shop, all the bread was priced the same, irrespective of the brand. Now you'll see bread, there's differentiation between prices of the different bread brands, and there's variation across the brands. There's more specials, you know, different bread companies offering special offers of bringing prices down, and there's far more competition now from in-house bakeries and supermarkets for bread. So there are indications that in this market there's higher levels of rivalry that is emerging on these grounds. But it's something that, you know, I mean, I would encourage people to be conscious and aware of this when they are at their local supermarket next time. Check the different prices and whether they're staying the same or going up or down. Okay, finally, monitoring and evaluation of merger conditions. I'll be very quick here. I need to say, firstly, that merger conditions, as I pointed out, must be designed to remedy a merger-specific problem. In other words, you know, a merger-specific anti-competitive harm or merger-specific public interest concern. It just doesn't give us any legitimacy as an institution to be placing conditions on a merger that has nothing to do with that merger, that has to do with something else, or it's out of control of the parties of that merger. Essentially, there are two broad categories of conditions that get placed. The one are structural remedies, this includes divestiture, like we did in a Sasol case, although that wasn't a merger case, but you can ask parties to, you can ask a firm to break up, to sell parts of the firm, to sell a subsidiary. So you break up firms, divestiture, you can prohibit cross-shareholdings and cross-directorships, because these are often mechanisms through which collusion occur. If I'm sitting on the board of two different firms, I'll be the in-between person, for example, to facilitate the collusion between those two firms. So there's a category of structural remedies, and secondly, there's a category of behavioral remedies, and these are where you either say to a firm that you must continue to supply so-and-so after the merger, or you must continue to supply people. When you supply the different people you supply, you mustn't discriminate in your pricing between them. They must all be treated equally. Or you get firms to make investment commitments that they will invest this amount or that amount in further expansion. Or behavioral remedies include putting caps on retrenchments where, as a condition to the merger, you say you will only be allowed to retrench a maximum of however many people as a consequence of this merger, and not beyond that. Now, in response to some of your questions, I think I need to point out that, you know, all of these, even where the commission reaches a settlement with the party, has to go to the tribunal and becomes a tribunal order. Now, a tribunal order is, must meet certain legal requirements. You know, must have the competency of a legal document. It's akin to, it has the weight of an order of the High Court. Anybody kind of not fulfilling it has all the rules around contempt of court operating for somebody not fulfilling a tribunal order. The tribunal order, in general terms, you know, although all of these don't apply to every single one, certainly the first rule, but must have legal clarity, must be clear what it is saying. Things must be time-bound. If certain things need to occur, the order must say by when it must occur. In some instances, a trustee gets appointed to oversee a process, and that trustee must report back to the commission and sometimes the tribunal. The order stipulates reporting requirements on how often what should be reported to the commission, but not only that, what should be reported or what communication should be sent to the employees or the unions. This is if it's specific to the case and it's appropriate, of course, and how reports should be done to investors, shareholders, and indeed other stakeholders. And a very important feature of the vast majority, if not all, tribunal orders is that in a contested, I'm not talking about mergers in particular here, but in a contested case, a restrictive practice case, it requires for firms to put into place a compliance program. Okay, well, this is my... Okay, I'm going to leave that one. Okay, so how do we... there is a question on how we monitor merger conditions. Firstly, you know, some of the monitoring I said is built into the order. Merging parties must provide audits and reports to the Commission on Compliance. The question of trustees also providing this report. But merger conditions, I think, very, very importantly, and a point I really want to emphasize, is monitoring is not always something that is the responsibility of the competition authority. Because corporate governance responsibility of the of directors and auditors for compliance with laws and risk should obviously incorporate an element of monitoring internally what's happening in a firm. And of course, in any marketplace, should a competitor or a customer or any other market participant pick up that a particular firm is not complying with an order and it is to their disadvantage, they will let us know quicker than anything else that something is not being complied with. And penalties for non-compliance, which include unwinding the merger, which is undoing the merger, if you don't comply, I think serves as a very severe incentive for compliance. This is just a slide which I'm not going to speak to, but goes into the different kinds of cases, different kinds of conditions on cases that we've been monitoring over the last 2 or 3 years. I think that the general point around measuring impact of our work is something that we take seriously as an institution, because it's good for, that is what I think, you know, developing a framework for that is good for public management accountability. Questions that arise for us always is what is an appropriate time frame for measuring impact. How, in other words, how long after our intervention can any impact be noticed? Is it like 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years? And depending on how markets evolve and adjust to different changes and shocks and what happens otherwise and beyond our intervention will all determine the time frame it takes for our for impact to be seen. I should honestly say that sometimes causality and effects in complex business environments are difficult. In other words, you know, you can never say that A caused B and only A caused B, because there was a whole range of other factors in a complex environment that would have influenced decisions and processes in different directions. So sometimes it would be hard for us to claim that it was only because of our intervention that something happened, because obviously there's other things happening around in the society that the firm is operating in. We have, however, in the process of developing this framework for measuring impact, we have assessed the impact of 3 mergers for particular reasons, which I'll talk about now, and we plan to review the impact of some hospital mergers we've done in the past. But in truth, the focus of our impact analysis as the Commission has been on analyzing the impact of breaking up cartels, because that is where we feel most of the wastage is occurring around resources and the allocation of resources. Just very quickly, the 3 cases then that we've evaluated, merger cases had to do with a case in steel, which we approved, even though it was raising, the reason we had to do that one was that this was a merger that did lead to higher levels of concentration, but there were efficiency arguments that were made, and the tribunal decided that notwithstanding the fact that there were higher levels of concentration, the efficiencies outweigh this, and they approved the merger, and we thought it's a good idea to go afterwards and see, well, did this indeed happen? And we found that the efficiencies were indeed realized, and prices didn't increase considerably afterwards, and customers were able to provide some countervailing power to the suppliers. In the Astral Natchez cases had to do with the divestiture and that introduced independent suppliers, and we wanted to look at what the impact of that was. And then finally in the Marion Roberts cementation merger, we also found that there were no adverse effects to this merger when we evaluated it. Chair, I'm sorry if I've taken more time than I should have, but that's me.
Thank you very much. I guess members were listening attentively. I've looked at them and they were really listening attentively to what you were saying. Thank you for the presentation. May we then engage with this presentation? I'm noting Babu Ngonyama, Babu Ntuli, Babu Mubu, in that order, please.
Chairperson, the first question is on the Walmart case. With regard to the last and the condition, commission study vis-a-vis the fund. Now, my issue is, was the study exclusive or was it on top of the fund, in addition to the fund? Does it mean that the fund has actually fallen off, the idea of the fund has fallen off, pending and the results of the study. And that's the first question. The second one is the symmetry. Did you say symmetry or cemetery or what? Symmetry. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Now, on the symmetry, the Sandler's case, I just want to find out the issues that you're raising with regard to the Concorde vis-a-vis FCA. Did they manage to deal finally with all the contradictions regarding symmetry? Thank you. And so, because it really is quite an interesting and the situation that the picture you were painting here, and some of the issues definitely that were being raised, Chairperson, in my view, by the and the SCA were quite valid, and to some extent, because nothing we have to make sure, in my view, as a democratic government, we have to make sure that even institutions like the competition and the commission have to be and beyond reproach and on matters and that are affecting the market and competition. And I don't want to go deeper on what I'm saying. I hope and the honor or the Sam is actually understanding the point that I'm trying to make. And I think that SAs and the accurate what you call the pointed and the specification with regard to the issues for investigation vis-a-vis complaints, I thought they would be within that context. But the point is that Sandler's case has it now managed to finalize those contradictions. The last one, Chair, is the Sasol case. Sasol is a South African company, in my view, and that we are proud of. And that's the bottom line, and with me. There are many multinationals out there, and Sasol is a company in South Africa, and therefore it cannot be in our interest to actually make it and to go down. To some extent, there must be a way of ensuring that whatever interventions that we make, but Sasol must continue to thrive as a South African company within the context of the very proudly South African. And therefore, is then no case for political intervention. And then now, beyond surfacing the issue of all the matters relating to competition and the stipulations that you have referred to, is there no case for political intervention directly to Sasol, and for actually making things difficult for smaller producers, for local producers, so that it is kind of implored to Sasol that they have to find a way of making things easy, so that it's a win-win situation. Thank you.
Thanks, Baba Mbanyama. Baba Ntuli.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. I want to check particularly on the Walmart manager or Walmart management. I'm checking the 503 workers were they reinstated or reemployed? Because I remember there was such an argument whether reemployed or reinstated. Because the conditions are not the same, I mean, for the workers, if you can put them clean. And then, you said the level of imports was high before the merger. What is it now after the merger? Is it the level of imports still high, or is it going down? when it comes to the ruling of the court, the appeal court ruling, I just want to check the public interest after the ruling. Were there any gains towards the public interest, or after the ruling was just the same? I'm talking about here the competitiveness and the public interest, as we have always tried to balance the two when we are making a decision. Lastly, Chair, although you did not, this was not presented here, I just want to find out from the Competition Commission, what makes the businesses in South Africa to always to compare to say it is very expensive to make business in South Africa compared to other countries? What are the reasons? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Babu Ntuli, Ntatemuhu.
Thank you, Chair. My first question relates to what my colleague here has asked in relation to the Commission's investigation into the merger that revealed very high levels of... but I wanted to take another dimension to that question. One of the things that we understood the benefits of this merger will be is that there's going to be more variety of products that will be available to the consumer, because of the fact that there's going to be a much bigger source of those products when the two companies merged. But why is it that means then, my understanding, my simple understanding is that means then there will be more imports coming in because there are so many other sources of this product. But what is this finding? Does this finding contradict just what I'm just trying to say? Maybe I'm not getting the message of it. The second one is on Sasol. My colleague, Honorable Ngonyama, has also touched on this, but I just want to get an understanding. If Sasol enjoys a rebate on the input, that means that it has more or less a monopoly on this. But then if it's charging excessive prices on the input that other companies would like to use on their product, can government remove that rebate? The last one is, on regulated products such as fuel, can complaints be laid against such traders if it's found that they're not complying with the regulated price, charging maybe a higher price? Can individuals lay complaints against such?
Thank you, Dr. Mubo. Thank you very much. I'm looking at the time. We're still within time. We're intending to finish at 12, at 1. I just want to find out, Mr. Ramburu, and from the Commission and the Department. You say you continuously indicated that it is not the role of the Commission to monitor the implementation. I don't know why I'm saying that. It is not your role. There's a Commission, and therefore there are certain decisions that are taken as a result of conclusions made by the Competition Authority, whether at your levels, at the Competition Authority levels or different levels up to the appeal court, or at the justice system itself level. Who then is responsible for monitoring if it's not the Commission itself? I'm asking this because when I look at the Act, the purpose of your of the act, which is your existence at the end of the day, is to promote and maintain competition in the Republic in order to promote the efficiency, adaptability and development of the economy, that's one, to provide consumers with competitive prices and product choices, that is two, to promote employment and advance the social and economic welfare of South Africans, that's number three, to expand opportunities for South African participation in world markets and recognize the role of foreign competition in the Republic. That's number four. Number five, to ensure that small and medium-sized enterprises have an equitable... And to promote a greater spread of ownership, in particular, to increase the ownership stakes of historically disadvantaged persons. I take from this mandate, your role is very direct, not indirect. And therefore, I don't understand, because to me, it's off, you have to get an outcome. It's not just about legalities, you know, ensuring that they are, you meet your legal, the certain legal requirements. There was a question here about whether there is no flexibility in the work that you are doing of allowing intervention where it's possible. And I don't know intervention by who, or did it say, I thought you said executive. I heard you well, Babu Ngonyamane, you said executive intervention in your question, yes. You know, I'm asking that because it brings about confusion. If we look at the mandate or the reason why the Act was established and therefore why you were established, and the actual practical work that you are doing in relation to this particular mandate. Because through this, we must see those kind of changes, the transformation happening, you know, everybody being having access to, you know, to, in terms of participating in the economy. The interests of the previously disadvantaged being taken care of, and so forth and so forth. But in all what we are doing, I don't see that. I don't see that because continuously, the Commission continuously indicate to us that they do not have power to do certain things. And if you recall last time when we were dealing with your strategic plan document, we also raised this frustration because it's something that at the end of the day, I don't know where should we go because, yes, the department has to come in, but at the end of the day, it will also be said the department is interfering, even though you are its entity. We don't know really what should happen. Should we leave out there and say, okay, you're doing your work, and therefore we shouldn't interfere, we shouldn't guide, we shouldn't, you know. Where do we get that space? Who then is then given that space? At what period? To ensure that this very same issue that ensured your existence are really...
Can you give us an example?
This, I've just read the purposes of your existence. That's as per your act, the act that's governing you. It tells us the aim, why this act, why we came up with this act. These are the things we needed to achieve, or we aspire to achieve at the end of the day, as a country. That's why when you go further into the Act, it also stipulates as to what are those issues that are within and those that you cannot, for instance, deal with that are outside the boundary. So this is the frustration we have because We just asked about some of these issues. You came with a problem that you cannot inter. For instance, the issue around Sasol is about the challenge that South African businesses are uncompetitive internationally. Is it because of standards? And how to, you know, it's a very broad statement that is sometimes debatable if we were to debate it politically. But we're not going to engage to the, on that because the minister is not here. We're supposed to be discussing with on policy issues. Just asking you as the implementers of this act, how then do we find space in terms of, in as far as ensuring that we are convinced that we are at the right direction to achieve this particular goal? I just want to ask you that broad question so that you come in to say whatever that you, in response to that broader question. Over to Babu, Mr. Ramburu.
Thank you very much, Chair. I will ask Tembi, my deputy, to fill in anything I leave out or and specific questions I'd like him to look at. So the first set of questions, the first question was about in relation to the Walmart case, the relation, the clarity on what is the fund and what is the study going to. My understanding is that one of the things that emerged in the course of this was a contestation around whether the 100 million rand that Walmart was prepared to put into a fund, whether that was indeed sufficient, or I think there were suggestions that it was too low and that it might should have been higher. And what the court essentially did is they said, look, there's one area we haven't looked at in sufficient detail, and this is the area around these global value chains. Let's have a study into this, understand this more deeply, and then design what the fund will do on the basis of the study. Sandy, do you want
to? Yeah, just to answer, Sean, quite correct, but what it means is that the fund, as you correctly say, is pending the decision on how it should be designed. So in other words, they've accepted the principle that there may well be a need for a fund, but the decision of the tribunal is in a sense frozen, pending the court's determination on how the fund would be structured and how much the fund would be for and that sort of thing.
Okay, thanks.
Oh, sorry, just a follow-up on the date. I mean, the judgment was handed on the 9th March, so around June. Yeah, 9th of March, around June should be when the study should be finalized.
Okay, then the question about, there's a question around whether the question of symmetry has been finally put to bed with respect to the Senves case. And the answer is no. There's two other cases that deal with different parts. You know, I drew this diagram, and if people want symmetry between every two steps, or the first step and the last step. And so in the nature of court cases, the Senves case is only decided on one part of it. And in the Senves case, whether the tribunal could have made an order contrary to or other than what was complained of or what was referred. And the other two cases deal with different, with other parts of that chain, and I think collectively they will solve all these problems, but certainly some of the principles will apply beyond the kind of specific part of the chain, if you like, that case is dealing with. Your point around the fairness is very, very well taken. I mean, this point has been slogged in this case. This is what the case, this is was business's point. I mean, business was beginning to cast the commission as, you know, a law unto themselves. They don't respect procedure. They interpret widely, and essentially these cases were trying to get us to interpret things more narrowly. And of course, you know, we felt that the law, that the line was being drawn at an unreasonable place, and the courts agreed with us. I think the whole question here is, if you think of whose rights you are protecting, of course there's the rights of the firms. Everybody has a right to know exactly what they're accused of and what case they need to be met. But one of the things that this situation was resulting in is it was requiring complainants to be very well versed in the law and articulate their complaints with a great degree of sophistication and precision. They all had to be complainants, or had to be lawyers now and come and say, and we felt the complainant could just come to us and say, look, I'm being cheated here, and that should be enough for us to be pursuing an investigation. I think the biggest injustice here of the SCA decision was that it wasn't giving the ordinary person on the street the right to complain and have their complaint heard properly. It was requiring too much of them. So just to show you, the Competition Commission is completely committed to the question of issues of fairness and treating all parties with fairness, and indeed sticking to the law, not kind of going against it and sticking to the confines of our mandate. Your points about the Sasol case, I mean, there's a lot of points you raised, and part of the problem that we sit within the competition authorities, not only on the Sasol case, but I can tell you now the Mittal case, the forestry cases, telecoms in some instances, is precisely the political economy of these firms, that a lot of these firms that are problematic, if you like, have been firms that were previously state-owned, some of them currently state-owned, SAA, and you know, why these firms, the legitimacy for owning these firms or starting these firms also always has to do with some nationalistic point around national pride, you know, our big company. And that's all very fine and well, but actually the problem I'm alerting to people here too is it is those very firms, and in this case specifically Sasol, who, to put it crudely, who are doing us in here by not allowing, by charging excessive prices for local manufacturers to develop as a manufacturing sector. And that's the point we're making. So your question about political intervention, I'm not going to kind of answer that very directly. But some of these firms are private firms now, so they have their own boards. But certainly where government is a shareholder in a firm, South African Airways is one example, we would expect them as shareholders of firms to be advising their boards through their own governance structures to be doing both legally and developmentally the right thing. So I'm not sure if I've answered your question directly. But related to that is a number, and I want to go straight to that, a number of other questions from the chair regarding the relationship, I think, between us and regulators and other institutions in society. Okay, I think that, you know, it is for all public sector institutions in this day and age a question of accountability around, you know, proving that the resources that we take from the fiscus we're using properly and we're giving proper outputs outcomes, and, you know, we're doing the job we're meant to be doing. That's a fair point. I think that this is not always very easy. We need to distinguish very clearly between concepts like what is an output and what is an outcome and what is impact, and they all mean different things. You know, administratively, I can tell you this is, we deal with X number of mergers a year. That's just output that doesn't tell you about the impact that we're having. And I think more and more people want to know about impact, you know, what's happening in real life, how has your decision changed that. And I mean, I think we are alive to that, and we are we engage with that because that is the feedback that improves our work, whether we've done, you know, whether an outcome is not achieved. But we don't spend all our time concentrating on that. Where it's appropriate, as I said, in those particular mergers, we have pursued it. In the case of cartels, we want to take that very seriously and look at the impact we're having in breaking up the cartels. I think that the one thing that we, in our point, this is a discussion that's going to go on for a long time, but the one point I would really like to make is in the passage that you read, I think it's very clear that our purpose is to promote competition in order to achieve those other things. It's not our job to go directly and straight to those other things. We promote competition in order so that those other things can be enabled. The point I'm making here is that the Competition Commission is not the sharp policy instrument to deal with each one of those other things listed. In other words, if you look at BE or small business or international competitiveness, in government's toolbox of all the interventions they have and are able to apply on the economy, there are much sharper tools to be used to give direct effect to employment and to competitiveness and to BE, and we're all familiar with those. We're not the sharpest tool. We're the sharpest tool to promote competition. And we are saying, and in some ways, our act is recognizing that in promoting competition, you know, what will result from that is all these other policy objectives we have as a country.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to come in, but I think you are really provoking when you come to that. I just want to, we understand clearly the act, and you are saying that you are not the tool, and you're not saying it today only, you've been saying it repeatedly,
yeah.
And it's in the act. I really want to understand the actual, you are saying you're promoting competition, and it's clearly elaborating why you are doing that. I can give you an indication of, for instance, the bread cartel, the Pioneer Food issue, just as an example. I want you to talk to that. Why then did we have an outcome that says, do one, two, three? In order to promote the very same issues that you are saying they are not part of you, if really you were not about that. And I really want to make this clear, because these are the questions that we get confronted with. And it's very difficult to answer those questions because the Act aims to get those issues at the end of the day, to make those issues very clear to our public. So if you're saying you are not directly involved, you are just looking at general competition issues, what does that mean? In essence, when you look, what outcome, for instance, when you look at an issue, what do you intend to get out of it? And why are you doing it? What do you get? Is it about the businesses? Is it about making sure that there's competition? The pricing issue, why do you put pricing issue then? Why do you put, for instance, issues of, though I just want to understand, if you are not aiming to contribute towards employment, for instance, that means to me that you are not, when you look at a matter before you, you don't look at it with the eye of those six issues, and I get worried. That's the impression I'm getting. You may correct me if I'm wrong. But the impression as you respond that I'm getting says, we are just technical people, and therefore those general issues do not involve us. And that says to me, you are not more concerned about the outcome, you are just concerned about ticking the box that we've done this, there was this complaint, we've looked at it, we've in investigated, we preferred, there's a conclusion, and that's where it ends. And then anything above that is not yours, it's somebody else's. This is the interpretation I'm getting. And I just want you today at least to clarify that so that I'm also clarified, other members are clarified. We live here with a clear, you know, understanding of why do we have competition commission or competition authorities in place in South Africa? Why do we have this act that wants to achieve 1, 2, 3 that was set for particular purposes and so forth and so forth? I just want you to clarify that issue, Mr. Ramboros, because as you explain, I get very confused, I must say. I don't know if it's me because I'm very, very, you know, I take time to understand issues.
Can I ask you a question then? Okay, are there not many pieces of legislation in this country that start off in their preamble saying, you know, whether they're in education or in health or anywhere else, they say, we're going to do this because we want a non-racist, a non-sexist society. And then it goes on to say all the things it's going to do in education, right? Let's take that example. Now, the assumption there is that by doing all of these interventions in, say, education or health in anywhere, we are contributing towards a non-racist and non-sexist society, although this initiative, whatever it is, by the Department of Education, is not the direct and sharpest tool we have to deal with racism or with sexism or with gender. I mean, I think let's not kind of confuse the kind of aspirational things that this whole society wants to move with. And because something is mentioned in one act, we forget the main focus of the act, and then we say, well, but what are you doing for this? I mean, I think that's the argument.
So, in your opinion, what is the main focal point of the competition commission? What are you aiming to achieve? In, you know, tangible things that you want to do to, that you're aiming to achieve in order to contribute to those issues. Because my understanding is that all of us, we contribute in one way or the other.
Sure.
But everybody has his or her stake in everything we are doing. That's why pieces of legislation are there to govern our work. So that at the end of the day, we can be able to say, this is what we have done in contributing to this. But you know, tomorrow, if education comes and say, in contributing towards a non-racial society, we are not going to bother ourselves about schools that only practice Africans as the medium of education, or practice Sotho as a medium of instruction in any school. But I take that and say it's okay, is it right? Because I feel that they as education have to input to do something to ensure that schools, at the end of the day, represent the general aspirations of the Constitution. Because that is what we're trying to get. So that you don't continuously say, no, that's not our role.
But
that's where I'm coming in. Where you say, it's not us, it's somebody else's.
Sure, okay.
Yes.
To be fair, our act very clearly says what we can and can't do. It's clear, it's there, you know, what, where. So, I mean, it should be clear to everybody, this is what is allowed in terms of our powers, and this is not. It says where the public interest factors you mentioned, if there are instances in the Act where that is specifically applied, and we have to apply it, and it's clear. I mean, I think
you should give your deputy, he seems to be wanting to, so that we stop dialogue. Can we give him that opportunity quickly on this matter before you continue?
Sorry, Jay, you might have picked up my irritation a little bit with the exchange, because I do really think that if one were to observe the exchange, you would think that we are miles apart when we are not, because I mean no one would suggest that an economic agency like the Commission existing in this context of high unemployment and poverty has no role to play in resolving some of the societal problems. And it's very clear in the debate. have all the time, whether we are working on our strategy. The premise is, what is the outcome we want to achieve? So I think that the tension between policy instruments from government represents, I think, the problems that governments all over the world have on how to integrate policy instruments. Let me give you an example. I mean, we have this discussion all the time about, is the best policy instrument to achieve employment the Competition Commission? The reality is, in order to promote employment, you might have to talk about SMMEs, and to talk about SMMEs, you need a policy instrument to finance them. You need to create a market for them. So the initiatives that are being taken by the department on local procurement are an example of a policy instrument that's designed to do that. So I think if we're going to sort of pigeonhole ourselves when we approach the discussion, we're going to fall into a trap of the Commission coming across as being defensive, and at the same time, on the other hand, having expectations that are too high for what the Commission could achieve. Because I think that there's a balance between the two. There's a reality that, in the past, there has not been a lot of focus on public interest. We've acknowledged that ourselves. And as we go along, it is becoming increasingly clear. I mean, this CAC judgment on Walmart, I think, touches on this point, that issues of SMMEs, and in our, much as we looked at local procurement, the extent to which the judge on Walmart calls upon the parties to bring evidence, to look seriously at the value chain. I think it's something that we take to heart, that these are the things that we're going to be required to do. So what I'm saying is, there is a policy tension. I think Shan is quite correct. There is a policy tension, and sometimes there could be too much expectations on the authorities. But the answer is not to say we have no role to play at all. The answer is integrating within government better.
I think I'm that at least lowers my
Chair, I wanted to
blood level. Yes.
Yeah, with that blood level having been lowered now, Chairperson, I wanted to say that the question is quite a profound question, and quite a complex and involved question, which requires us to maybe in the next meeting, if we can allow it, Shan and Chair, that we have it as an item in the agenda so that we can deal with this and the tension and the once and for all. And I do remember that when we met down that other side, a similar question like to this was raised, and because the responsibility of the committee is to do oversight, and our oversight is broadly on economic issues and the priorities that are all known within the context, and the Tim Ngosi is referring to the context of high unemployment and poverty in South Africa. And so whatever that we do, we try to put it within that context. But there are also realities and that are sort of imposed by the restriction of the Act, and they are referring to, which means, well, let's actually deal with this issue as an item, maybe in the next meeting, Chairperson, that's my appeal, so that we can dispose of it. I have another question that I wanted to follow up, and on the issue of this the FASO. I just wanted to make a follow up, Chairperson, on this question of political intervention on FASO, if the Chairperson would allow me to continue.
Yes.
My question, my issue then is that I do understand why, Sean, you don't want to respond directly to my question. I do understand. And because it requires maybe a political and a mandate to say that, yes, there is a. But I'm happy even by that reluctance, because it actually confirms now that it's an issue that we have to take up ourselves as a committee, Comrade Chair, and the Honourable Chair, to this issue with SASOL, and especially within the context of the previous debate and of the local procurement. Because SASOL cannot be allowed to get away with murder and lift up the prices. At the same time, we talk of local procurement, promotion of local procurement. It means that there's a case for us to sit down with SASOL or whatever structure that can actually do that. And to understand the costs involved with SASOL and so on and so forth, within the context only and not with interfering with SASOL and the business, and within the context of making sure that we promote this local procurement. And so I'm really saying so, because this thing of just saying that there's high price and so on and so forth for SASOL, it's a South African company. I've heard you, Sean, when you talk about these companies that are South African and were state-owned and so on and so forth, and that are also playing truant in one way or the other. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think, in the interest of time, I guess we'll have to agree with that. But generally, if it's a problem of the policy or the act itself that is making it difficult for you to realize the very same objectives of the very same act, I think we have to look at that. Then I would agree that in the next meeting we focus on that. I think let's leave it in that spirit. I don't know what the department says in this regard, Mr. Williams, because I think these are the issues that we are confronted with, and we have to make sure that whatever entity that we have, whatever public institution we have, really ensures that it contributes towards the transformation of the country. And that would be emancipating its people economically also in various ways. And we cannot have entities that are established by government that really do not see their input into that kind of work or their contribution having that kind of general impact on that. Something that is tangible that they can, get out of the work that they're doing. Because really we have to get to that. We have to say, this is Competition Commission in this financial year, this is what we're going to be trying to get, even though sometimes it's very difficult in terms of their work, that's what they said. But we have to ensure that we make their work easy and very flexible in such a way that they are able to achieve that which we have mandated them to achieve. What do you say in this?
I just want to say that we take note of all the issues raised by this committee. We will definitely take this back to our principals. At this stage, we will not comment on it, and the issues are in your hand at this stage, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. I think these are issues also to be followed. We hope that the minister will be available in that meeting, because I can understand that as I raised some of these issues with Mr. Ramburu, these are highly policy-related issues or political issues, and he's venturing to answer them. And, a politician and administrator, when they get together, sometimes there's that challenge. And it's important that, because we have expectations, of course, and those expectations, if they are not able to be fulfilled, at the implementers must indicate to us why are they not able to be fulfilled. and allow us an opportunity to input into that so that we are able to, at the end of the day, achieve that. I think that is the gist of everything, and I appreciate the explanation. But the challenge is that it's our time now, Mr. Ramboros, and I would really request that the remaining responses be part of your presentation in the next your next presentation. But then we also look at the issues that we just raised from the perspective of the Act itself. What are the impossibilities? Why? What can be done to remove those blockages, for instance, if there is? Last time you told us about the Ed Amendment Act. We followed that up politically. We are able to check to say where what is, and we are able to account for that. But then the challenge is that it's not yet implementable. But then even if we implement that, you said yourself in the last meeting that there are still shortcomings. So there will continue to be these shortcomings. What we are asking is that let's look at those shortcomings, let's address them so that we are able to be convinced at the end of the day that the existence of Competition Commission makes a difference in the life of South Africans, especially in terms of addressing the previous challenges that we had in the previous system. So I think that is where we want to get to at the end of the day. I take your point that we might be talking, you know, differently, but in the same direction. And let's talk one language, because at the end of the day, I want to talk the same language as you. I don't want to talk differently from any of you. And nobody from the committee should talk differently from any of you. We must all talk the same. This is the purpose of our meetings, so that we are able to be convinced. It's not just about convincing us. It's about us getting convinced and also agreeing with you that that is the same, we are on the same path. That is what I wanted to say to conclude. And I'm hoping that the department, Etienne, and the people, Mr. Williams, will be able to, and the DDG will be able to take this up and then come up with something for us to further discuss, because competition issues, especially on the public interest issues, are the issues that are very contentious at the moment. With that note, may I then allow the meeting to close and indicate that we will come back to you with the next date of the meeting. Hopefully it should be in the beginning of the next term so that we don't waste much time, which is starting in July.